ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello. How are you feeling? If you're ruminating about someone at work, either because of a disagreement or a difficult conversation that you're avoiding, this episode is for you. So why don't you find a couch, get comfy, sit or lie down, because you're about to get a little session that just might expand the way you think about and handle conflict at work. I'm Lisa Leong and you're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National, helping to make your work life better. In this episode, we'll explore the sometimes invisible forces that shape our relationships at work with psychotherapist and New York Times bestselling author Esther Perel. Now, Esther is also an organisational consultant from Fortune 500 companies around the world. Esther, hoe gaat het?
Ah, thank you. Heel goed.
Ik ben in Leuven gelernt. Flemish.
Je hebt in Leuven gestudeerd, my birth town, yes.
Wow. So I spent a year there, and that's all the Flemish I know. Now, a lot of us spend time actively avoiding conflict at work. Why?
You can avoid it. You can try to actively avoid it as much as you can. It doesn't mean that there won't be any conflict. First of all, conflict is inherent to relational systems. It is the way people deal with differences. It is part of how people deal with differences, how people deal with issues of power, how people deal with actually the four major pillars of relational intelligence in the workplace. Trust. There can be conflict around trust. Belonging. There can be conflict around belonging. Recognition. There can be loads of conflict around recognition. And collective resilience, which the absence of which will create a lot of conflict. So the first and foremost thing to say is conflict is intrinsic to relationships, all relationships. Conflict isn't bad, but there is good conflict, productive conflict, and dysfunctional conflict. But that doesn't mean that conflict in and of itself is a problem.
You often say that a conflict isn't really about what the work disagreement is about. There's something deeper. And so do you want to go into those deeper things that we might actually be in conflict about?
It's interesting because our initial question is often, what is the fight about? And I tend to ask, what is it that people are fighting for? And from the work of Howard Markman, you see that there are three major things that people are actually fighting for. And if you go for that, you'll bypass the trap of the details, which are really not relevant. I did attend the meeting. I wasn't included. You know, we fight for power and control.
Okay, so that's number one, and control. How does that manifest?
Whose priorities matters more? Who gets to make the decisions? Am I included as a stakeholder in the decision about the thing that I'm supposedly responsible for?
You didn't put me on the email. That's
right.
Power.
But we can discuss the email or we can discuss priorities, power, decision making. Number two, care and closeness, which is trust. So the first is power, the second is trust. Trust is, do you have my back? Can I rely on you? Can I lean on you? Will you not put your interests ahead of me? Will you not push me aside to put yourself ahead?
What would that be in a work context? How might that come out?
Oh, the classic one is I do the work, you take the credit.
Oh.
that's a very common one. I thought that we were doing this project together. How come my name appears at the bottom of the page? That one actually also links to recognition. But it is, trust is, we have a shared set of assumptions about how this relationship works and especially how the cycle of reciprocity takes place in our relationship. And when you break the trust, that's why the breaches of trust are so important, it basically shatters all the assumptions. I thought we were in this together. I thought that you had my back. I thought I could count on you. I believed in you. All of this is what goes when trust is broken. Now, at work, the interesting distinction is sometimes you can trust the character Like, I trust you as a person. I think you're a good person. But I don't trust your competence. I'm not sure you can actually get the work done. So we have to really be careful when we talk about, I don't trust. We have to say for what? So that it is contextual and not totalistic. Number three, respect and recognition. Respect and recognition is, I value your contributions. I see it. And I make it public. And I realize that I could not do it without you. So the recognition is to one person, but the person who does the recognition also acknowledges their interdependence with the person they're recognizing. And do you value me? So you have power,
trust,
and value.
And what's interesting is, would you go back and map out maybe a recent conflict at work and then try and have a look at what is the thing that this is actually about? Because I'm thinking,
what is the problem underneath the problem?
I used to have work in a partnership with one other person, and one time we had a disagreement and he said to me, oh, you're a bottomless pit of compliments. You always need me to be saying, oh, you're doing a good job and thank you for your contribution. And he said, we're in partnership together. You should just assume that because we work together that you're doing a good job. So I feel like that could be my but falling in the third
what
category.
What did you do? What was your reaction to that?
I think I laughed and I probably agreed, but I did feel a bit stung.
Yes,
that
it was a contemptuous statement. Yes. It basically says, you know, I'm an adult and you are a needy child, and I don't feel like feeding you. And my first thought was, you know, the metaphor of food has never nourished anybody. It's the act of eating. So he's basically saying, you know, you need constant reaffirmation. You're so insecure. And part of why one is this way sometimes is because we are with somebody who doesn't ever actually do the recognition. So we are part of a dynamic. Interestingly, this is not happening to me with everybody. So I think that sometimes it may be the actual response to an actual situation, which is that working with you often leaves one wondering, and that is a power game.
What do we do with that? And let's go deeper into power then, Esther. Because what do you mean by power at work? Because I know that you don't think it's about hierarchy.
No, I think that, like you know, power, like conflict, is there is no relationship. The minute you need somebody, they have power. The minute you rely on someone and you trust them, they have power. So power is a foundational piece of the relationship structure.
So are you saying then, let's say we had a leader and a team member, and that team member was always complaining and the leader feels like they need to appease them. Are you saying that the employee has the power then, not the leader?
Yes, and anybody who's ever had a two-year-old knows that the power can come from the bottom up.
That's interesting. Do you think people feel challenged by that definition of power? Because we think power is CEO, leader, and then...
Try to get a two-year-old to sit in a stroller who doesn't want to sit in it and see who has the power. So I think that when I give this as an example, we understand that power can come from the margin, power can come from the bottom up. The little one who doesn't want to be quiet when you need them to be quiet. I mean, they, of course, it's not intentional and they're not doing anything to you, but they have de facto, they have the power because you need them to be a certain way and they are not complying. And therefore, they have power.
And how does power interact with conflict?
Because a lot of conflict are about power dynamics. A lot of conflict are about power dynamics. Power dynamics can be that I am complaining about something, but you come back and you complain about something that you think is more important than me. So we're competing. Power dynamics can be that when I bring something up, like you did with your partner, instead of responding to the thing that you were talking about, they go and they do character assassination. You're such a needy, empty vessel. you know, that can never be filled. That's a character assassination. That doesn't answer anything that we were discussing. And it just kind of says, I establish myself as you are needy, dependent, and little, and immature, and I am your diagnostician, basically. I'm the one that's going to tell you what's wrong with you. That's power, to tell somebody what's the matter with them. So many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem, especially when it's you doing it. You know, but I don't magnify my problems. My problems happen to be, you know, accidents of circumstance. Your fuck-ups are actually, you know, a problem with who you are. I mean, we have a ton, I call them defeating strategies, but they are all power maneuvers.
Do you want to go through some of those defeating strategies?
Yeah, tit for tat is a power maneuver, right? You bring something up, I say, and what about that? Or, you know, instead of talking about one thing, I put all the dirty dishes in the sink.
The kitchen sinking.
Yes, I love it, kitchen sinking. And then you bring back, and then the kitchen sinking is often married with another strategy, which is the triangulation. And so agrees with me too. And I'm not the only one who says this. Let me bring in the troops, you know, to back me up so that it's not just me telling you, but it's all these people who now you can start wondering, and who is talking behind my back and what are they saying? And now we start wondering, can I trust any? I thought I was getting along with everyone. What are these people saying about me? Oh, that is power.
What do we do with these defeating strategies? Once we know, I guess we will say, oh, I sort of err towards kitchen sinking or...
Oh, that's nice, because you're giving me somebody who's actually relationally self-aware and sees what they're doing. I was thinking, what do you do when it's done to you?
Yeah.
You know, every single one of these strategies is meant to destabilize you. That's the power that I have, is I am defining the situation and you are meant to doubt yourself. My descriptions are fact. Your descriptions are feelings. Yours are subjective and mine are objective. All of these are strategies. When you're on the doing end and you notice what you're doing, that's great. Then I can say, well, can we stop the dirty fighting and disagree in a way that maintains people's dignity? That's not far-fetched. It's just that many people choose to do it differently.
Well, and so this working life at Anna, so we did get some questions from the audience.
It's here, Anna.
So how do you ask someone in a position of power for what you need without being judged as needy or entitled?
The question to Anna is this, Anna. First of all, do you think that that you're being needy by asking this? That's number one. Number two, do you think that there's a part of you that has been made to feel needy because there's been a shortage of something that you shouldn't even have to ask for? Number three, does this evoke experiences of neediness that are familiar to you? And the sheer act of going to an authority figure to ask for something is bringing back all kinds of familial stories or stories with the people who raised you about asking for help, wanting to be recognized, needing something from them. You know, have you been told during your life that your needs matter? Or do you come from a place where you've always been told, why do you need that for? And that is your unofficial resume that's coming with you to work when you're going to talk to your boss or your leader. We all have an unofficial resume. And so the next thing is, now if that person does that and says, I'm needy, are they basically trying to distract you from the very thing you're asking, and they're turning it on you instead of talking about the raise, the promotion, the fact that you didn't get the project that they told you that you would get. And now instead of taking responsibility for their behavior, they're putting it on you. And it's basically a blame tactic. That's power.
You're listening to ABC Radio National's This Working Life. I'm Lisa Leong, and we're exploring how to manage conflict at work with psychotherapist Esther Perel. We've got another listener here. This is Chloe.
Hi, Chloe. When conscientious, empathetic leaders encounter dysfunction, so whether that's broken processes, toxic dynamics, or overwhelming workloads, they often take it on as their personal responsibility to fix, even when the issues are structurally too large for one person. They internalize their team's emotional pain and try to shield others by absorbing the strain themselves. So what's happening in that relational dynamic? And how can they step out of overfunctioning without feeling like they're betraying their responsibility or abandoning their team?
Thanks, Chloe. Esther?
I think that is the question of the moment, actually. It's really broader than just if they encounter systemic failures or, you know, what you're asking is, what does leadership look like in times of crisis or in times of transition or in times of uncertainty is probably the word of the moment. And this overworking is one of the most typical things we do. By the way, it happens to therapists too. It's one of the real challenges in our own work is to work harder than the people themselves who actually need to do this. So I think the most important shift is to not overwork, is to understand that what you need is to create a holding environment, a container in which people can articulate their distress, their anxiety, their fears, their worries, be it around AI, be it around the political situations, be it about job losses, be it about changes at the hierarchy levels. They need a place to articulate the distress, but without it leaking out so that they can't do the work. You want to create the holding, the containing, and you want to offer three main things: calm, clarity, and structure. So that you ground people. Because if you don't, then the stuff will explode, it will leak out, and it will become chaotic. And what happens then is that systems fragment and people start to throw stuff at each other. That's the way you work hard without overworking.
How do you create that container and with that calmness and clarity without turning into a therapist for your team members?
The first thing you say is not, I've got this, I have the answers, I know, trust me. The worst one is, you must trust me, as if you can kind of impose this thing. You are a humble person who is leading a group of people who don't really know what's going to happen. And the best thing you can say is, we're going to do this together. We're going to try to have solidarity here. This is happening to all of us. I do not know, but I will make sure that we have the conditions to figure it out as best we can.
And that leads me to an anonymous question, which is about, if you are a leader and you are trying to be compassionate, but your team members just aren't performing, and even though you're trying to get them to perform, they're coming to you with all the complicated things about their life. What do you do then?
I think that this is a distinction that my friend Susan David, who wrote Emotional Agility, talks about a lot. It's like, you don't lead with wounds. You lead with scars. If you just do compassion, 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 you invite people to talk about their wounds all the time.
Mm.
You need to combine compassion with accountability and responsibility. And that means that they're also working with their scars, with their resilience, with their strengths, with the ability to deal with change, with adversity, with innovation, with things that doesn't come from them. The thing that is the main thing is that I am the therapist. You are the leader. You are the manager. You're the boss. They come to me, and even a good therapist is not there to just be compassionate, because the compassion invites people to stay within the wounds. And even if the wounds are mega and they're traumatic, we are all capable of post-traumatic growth. That is that we see in the challenges and the problems and the crises of our life, our work life, also lessons and opportunities and things that we can use to strengthen and to change. So I would say to you, the leader, compassion is very good, but if you just lead with compassion, you will have a group of people to whom you are inviting for them to bring you all their wounds, their regressive behaviors, their childlike longings, and you won't have a group of adults.
And so what question are you asking, or what are you doing as a leader to break out of that pattern?
What is a question around a scar is basically, how would you like to address this? I understand this is challenging, and that conversation we have had, and it's probably a conversation that belongs somewhere else. How would you like to address this? What are the skills necessary? Who should be involved? What is the timeline? Who's responsible for what? And I will support you in doing so.
Thank you. I've got another one here, another anonymous question from This Working Lifer. So this was on email. I'm an accomplished, experienced professional, yet with key leadership relationships, I find my confidence shrinking rather than expanding. I care deeply about growth and I do take feedback seriously, but the dynamic feels more diminishing than developmental. There is a blame dynamic that's also permeating with others. How do we recognize when staying and trying harder reflects maturity or when it becomes a form of self-abandonment?
I think that that is a foundational question to all relationships, not just to work, first of all. So this is to our person here who asked the question, you know, what am I gaining and what is to gain by staying, by forging ahead, by trying harder, by going back one more time versus is it time to stop, or does that mean I'm weak, or I'm giving up, or I'm not really strong, or they won, or any of that? And I'm going to answer by making one statement first and foremost. Your question highlights what I think are one of the most important truths about relationship dilemmas, is that they are complex. And they are often paradoxes that we learn to manage way more than problems that we solve. So this is not a, this is what you do. You know, I have indeed seen many people who, when they leave, tell me, I wish I had left sooner. And my answer is always, you left when you were ready to go. Either because life threw something at you, either because something made it so egregious and unbearable that you finally found it in you, the strength to say, I've had it. Some people define themselves as leavers. And some people define themselves as, for a host of circumstances of how they learned to be in the world, they learned that they had to stick it out. Generally, those who do the sticking out could learn to leave a little sooner, and those who are leavers could learn a little bit more staying power. So the answer is not a generic, the same for everyone. It's depending on what has been your dominant coping strategy, I will probably look at what's happening with the other side of this.
What do you mean by that?
If you've been the person who tends to jump each time, I want to talk with you about what's making it so hard to stay. You know, what happens to you when you stay? You instantly think I'm losing myself the minute you adapt to a system, because in effect there's a certain kind of fragility and insecurity around your identity, and so you experience instantly, if I do what you want, I've lost me.
Mm.
That's an issue. But on the other side, if you are a person who stays all the time and who gets to be defined by what others tell you and doesn't have enough of a sense of how do I attend to my own needs while not losing you, every relationship says, how do I hold on to me without losing you? And how do I hold on to you without losing me?
I mean, some really key issues here. One is that, as you say, humans are messy. Mm-hmm. And so in a workplace, we try and neaten things. That's what we do. We like to have lists and everything's mm-hmm. neat, but humans are actually messy. And then the second part is this word, the P word, paradox. And, you know, I do think that it is challenging the complexity of not having a binary answer to things, because we love right and wrong. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about conflict and our need to sometimes, when we're having a disagreement, be right over, healing a relationship.
Yes, 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 yes. We have a way of thinking that I'm rational and you're irrational. I see things, you are delusional. One brain works and it's mine. Yours is defective. There is something
that sounds familiar.
It's an amazing thing how much we sometimes want to be right. Because there is a sense that if I abdicate, I lose power. We're going to go to every one of the dimensions we just named, right? We lose power. We lose our identity. We lose our recognition. We lose our confidence. We are humiliated. We are defeated. We are ashamed. We are narcissistically wounded because we said, you're right. And what does it stand for? If it's so hard for me to admit, simply, you're right. I made a mistake. I fucked up. I could have, I should have, I didn't, etc. To say that, we have to be able to accept that we are flawed. That we are imperfect. We are messy. We are imperfect. We are flawed. But we still hold ourselves in high regard. If admitting my flaws and my imperfections and my mistake instantly brings up shame and embarrassment, then it's very hard for me to accept that you are right, because saying you are right instantly implies I am wrong.
So when we talk about how we handle conflict at work, I think listening and asking genuine questions to understand the other person's point of view is one approach. Can you give us some other tips on handling conflict at work?
Yes. But I think it's important to maybe start by, conflict is not the origin. Conflict is what evolves because of conditions that have been left unattended. If there is problems of trust and recognition and belonging and resilience, then you have conflict. It's the consequence. So when people say, how do you handle conflict? I think first let's handle all the other things that lead to conflict, the absence of those things. You know, let's talk about trust here. Is there a sense that people can actually, you know, say, I did this or I did not do this right? Or is the, can people talk openly without fearing repercussions? When people do the job, you know, the essential piece around recognition is not to say you did a good job. It's like telling your partner, thanks for bringing the milk. That's a nice thing to say. It's a nice thing to do. But it's very different than if you say to someone, thanks for being so thoughtful. One speaks to the behavior. Okay, you did this. One speaks to the character of the person, to the morality of the person. You are thoughtful. I'm included in your world. You don't just think about the fact that you like chocolate. You remember that I need milk. That being thoughtful is a whole different way. So recognition is way beyond praise. If you don't have that, then you can easily come and say to somebody, you're needy. You know, those dimensions, they're not one-on-one. They're at scale, you know. And systems put at scale what individuals normalize.
We've got this fun segment that goes at the end of our show, and it basically is our expert will give This Working Life as a tip that they can try in their life and work. So on the basis of conflict and power dynamics at work, can you give us a practical task that we can use as an experiment this week, and then people do it and then they report back? Is there something practical we can try to change or have a look at how we handle conflict at work, Esther?
I'd love for you to take a situation that is pertinent to your workplace and take three or four people and ask each one of them to highlight one aspect. Not the other aspects, just one. For example, one aspect is we should do this project. But another point of view says, no, we have too much on our plate. We should not take this on. And another one says we should actually cancel something else because this should take precedence and we should tell the people who already have worked for 6 months on that other thing, they can stop. And another one is, no, we should put this, I don't know, on a shelf for the next year and not even think about it at all. Find four different points of view about an issue and just speak only from that place. Let the disagreement come up. What happens in a situation like this is that people take on one thing and now they are banging, you know, the drum and just repeating constantly that one point of view, when in fact the issue probably needs all four different aspects to be addressed. I say four, it could be three, could be six. But stage a disagreement. Show how people lodge themselves in one idea and then become rigid about that idea as if they can't think about the rest. And then shuffle. Have each person take on another person's point of view.
Oh.
shuffle, so that you can see the rigidity is the process. The content is often less important than the process itself. It's not what you're saying that is so important. It's the fact that that's all you're saying.
And then what happens?
And then you'll begin to watch. Then you'll analyze what's it like to... I have to actually two exercises. This one is, what's it like to see the differences of opinion emerge? And what's it like when the same people shift roles, shift, take on a different angle of the story, of the dilemma, of the decision that needs to be made, etc.? And watch flexibility. I mean, this is agility in the make. Mm. So that's one. Actually, that's a good one. Because I would love to hear if anybody does it, please tell me about it.
We would love you to report back, and we will pass it on to Esther, and then we'll see what happens, shall we? Esther, together with Culture Amp, you've designed a game of stories called Where Should We Begin at Work? They're conversation cards to be used in workplace settings. So I've plucked out one of the cards here, and it reads, "Something I would like to change about the way I deal with conflict." Is there anything you would like to change about the way you deal with conflict, Esther?
Something that I would like to change is something I've actually been learning and practicing, which is that if I have something to say, I write it down first, often by hand, and I don't send it. It is the version where I get everything out of my system, but it is probably not the version you should read or hear. And then I write the second version, and that's the one that goes out. Because sometimes I'm like, and I have a ton of reactions, but it's not going to serve me very well. I mean, it's going to get it out of my system. It's a release in there. That's a good, you know, it's attractive, but it's really not useful. So I would love to be able to do that even more.
And is that something where you've decided that the way in which you deal with conflict is something which is absolutely a part of you but might not serve you with everyone?
Do I want to just dump on you all my resentments and my frustrations, or do I actually want to solve this problem? And for a while, I tended to be more someone who sometimes just want to dump. You absolutely need to know how I feel, okay? I mean, but that doesn't solve the thing. And it usually doesn't mean that I'm that interested in listening to you either. So calm down and then get it out, but put it in the river, let it flow with the water. Don't bury it. Don't bury it, but also don't plant it.
Esther Perel, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Psychotherapist and New York Times best-selling author, Esther Perel. Esther Perel also featured on a recent episode of All in the Mind, where they dive into how relationships have changed over the course of Esther's career. Here she's talking to host Sana Qadar about love in the age of AI.
Is this the biggest shift to hit human relationships?
I think that every time there has been a big shift, we have thought it's the biggest shift.
Right.
When the shift is the one that is you're dealing with, it feels enormous.
You can find All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Tim James on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naam, Melbourne. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can like or subscribe to our show on ABC Listen or anywhere you get your podcasts. And of course, you can share the love as well. Send it to a friend or a work colleague you think would enjoy This Working Life. I'm Lisa Leong. Until next time, work it like a charm.
It's very fun to talk with you because you're good at saying, yes, you're on track, yes, this is a good way to go. It's like you're constantly, you're like a ski teacher who is tracing in front of me.
Yeah. Thank you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.